Tina Guster, Amy Littlefield, Anna Osbeck, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, our engineer. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grant, David Prude, and Vesta Gadars. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, our website, democracynow.org. Thanks
hey,
for joining
Ariel,
us.
Hey, buddy, old pal.
So I want you to be my buddy.
Friends or buddies, as we like to refer to you as here at WBAI. Either way, we invite you to join us and become a member of this fine radio station. We want to partner with you, but we want to do it in the least imposing and most painless way possible. Here's the deal. It's called the Buddy Pledge. You give us your support for 12 months, and we give you access to the most eclectic music, as well as the best and thought-provoking news, talk, and community affairs. Sound good? See it in your heart to pledge a minimum of $10 per month. Each payment will automatically be deducted from your credit or bank statement, so there's no reminders needed. Just join us for a one-year membership and go online at www.give2wbai.org. That's give numeral 2wbai.org and be part of our vibrant community. WBAI New York.
Hello, we're the Black Angels over Tuskegee. Support WBAI 99.5 FM during the Spring Fun Drive by joining the Artsy Fartsy Show Theater Club. And come see our off-Broadway hit, Black Angels Over Tuskegee, at St. Luke's Theater.
It's an incredible show about the Tuskegee Airmen, now in our sixth year off-Broadway. Come out and learn about these important, incredible African-American heroes. You won't want to miss it. Learn more about our show at BlackAngelsOverTuskegee.com.
And support listener-sponsored radio, WBAI FM, by joining the Artsy Fartsy Show Theater Club to see the show Black Angels Over Tuskegee this June.
To join, visit give2wbai.org or call 212-209-2950 and be a part of the vibrant art scene as a theater club member.
Black Angels Over Tuskegee, straighten up.
Fly right.
WBAI Local Station Board will be having a meeting on Wednesday, June 10th, 2015, at the ARC Central Harlem Senior Center, 120 West 140th Street, between Malcolm X and Adam Clayton Powell Boulevards. The meeting starts at 7 p.m. The public is welcome.
And this is radio station WBAI New York, where the time is 7 o'clock. Time, once again, for Off the Hook. And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you tonight, joined by Mike.
Hi there.
Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
Annoying high pitch. Do you guys hear that annoying high pitch?
Yeah.
Where is that coming from?
I don't know, but I received a text message about it, too. So that's how annoying it is.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Let me see if I can diagnose this problem. It's coming from my microphone. How about that? Because if I turn my microphone down...
You don't hear it anymore.
Oh, you hear it a little bit, actually. Interesting. Well, folks, I don't think there's anything we can do about this annoying high-pitched whine. Just, couple it with my voice, and now you have two annoying high-pitched whines. How about that? Also joining us on the phone from Seattle is Kyle. And, wow, the high-pitched whine got even louder.
Hi, I am here. I can hear you. I also hear the high-pitched whine.
It's probably going to be the most popular part of the show, but we'll just have to deal with it.
Well, I'm talking to you live from one of the great hacker capitals of the West Coast.
That being
a very sunny
Seattle.
Day here.
Uh-huh.
Very hot. Yeah.
Well, that's
the city of.
Yeah, that's cool. And for those people wondering, we will be patching Bernie in later. We don't really at the moment have the ability to patch two people in. God knows what kinds of crazy sounds we'll have if we try that. And we also don't have the ability to take phone calls yet, but I just confronted our general manager in the hallway, and it's narrow enough where he couldn't pass unless he answered my question, and he said the phone lines will be installed fairly soon, so we will be able to hear the cheery voices of our listeners in the not-too-distant future.
I look forward to that and to getting rid of this wine.
Yeah, well, maybe one of you can go fetch an engineer or something that might understand what the high-pitched wine is all about. I don't want to keep the high-pitched wine for the entire show. I'd rather not do that. What I would like to do, though, is go over a couple of stories that have been in the news lately. Kyle, you're welcome to stay on for as long as you wish. For the whole hour, because we're going to bring Bernie in.
I'm just doing some bills here.
It sounds like you're shredding something.
No, well, I have to catch up on my finances and everything. So.
Well, that's one way to catch up on them, I suppose. Okay, so we have this story here, which I think is kind of a fun one to start off with. Okay, if I turn him down and the wine gets a little better, but wow, this is annoying. The top six dumbest hacks of all time. Oh, Reggie's here. Reggie, you know about this high-pitched wine? Okay, Reggie's here to try and fix the high-pitched wine while I continue speaking. The top six dumbest hacks of all time, as reported in TechWorm, with advanced technology, high-speed internet, and availability of much more technologically advanced gadgets, it has helped hackers to get basic and easy access to our personal and confidential credentials, be it bank accounts or access to social networking sites. Keep in mind, this is not me speaking. The demonization of hackers is just unbelievable. We'll have some more about that in just a little bit. Normally, people are as scared of these cyber crooks and hackers as these people are believed to be extraordinarily smart. Hey, you got rid of the high-pitched wine. How'd you do that?
I don't know.
Okay. For future reference, we just call Reggie in and he'll fix it, but he doesn't know how. Okay, that's good.
I'm like Fonzie.
Okay, thank you. This is why we have talented people around here that can fix things, and other people around here who break things. Okay, so anyway, this is kind of an outline of some of the dumbest hacks of all time. I take exception with a few of them. 4 years back, in 2011, a dumb hacker named hacked Kelly Osbourne's email account. She's the one from Dancing with the Stars. The hacker not only traced her old and new emails, but also forwarded them to his own personal email account, which could be easily traced. This is considered to be one of the world's dumbest hacking incidents, which indicates that the hacker was so dumb that by forwarding the emails to his personal account, he actually invited police to trace and arrest him. Well, you know what? Maybe he wasn't trying to hide all that much. And before we start pointing fingers and calling people dumb, I should point out that you spelled incidents INCIDENCE instead of NTS. So, you know.
It is a word. It's just the wrong word.
It's the wrong word. Yeah. A spell checker would not catch that. And obviously that's what you relied upon. Okay, then we have self-proclaimed hacktivist Shahi Mirza. Way back in 2008, a group of people defaced the military website of Bangladesh government, which is known as Rapid Action Battalion, RAB. The website was www.rab.gov.bd. It was sabotaged, forced to temporarily shut down. Moreover, when people entered the site, the elite security site, they found a message posted which stated, "Hacked by Shahi Mirza." Mirzar, a 21-year-old student of the Institute of Management and Technology, pled guilty and was told the authorities he did not have any ill intent in hacking the site. The authorities were able to retrieve the site after about 24 hours. It was also found that he had earlier hacked the websites of 22 organizations, including one that belonged to the Army. Obviously, that was and they make fun of the spelling of something that was put on the hacked webpage. He spelled genius wrong. The author of this article is spelling words wrong left and right, so okay, fine.
making fun of him for that, and also for the fact that he got caught. This is the thing, you know, when sites are hacked, it's not always hacking that's behind it in the first place. Sometimes it's just running a script and doing something really simple. But being caught does not indicate that you're dumb. Being caught just indicates you're not a good criminal and that you might not know how to cover your tracks. But you still could have done an extremely clever thing. So you might see this article floating around, six dumbest hacks of all time, and they're really, they're not that dumb.
I want to know who voted for the six dumbest hacks of all time. I mean, I certainly didn't get a ballot myself. I don't know if you guys did, but whatever consensus this is, I think I might question their methods.
Well, this came from some security expert named Alan Wiesuk, and that's all I know. So I just figured that might be an amusing thing to focus on for a moment. U.S. Army said Monday it temporarily took down its website after a group calling itself the Syrian Electronic Army hacked into the site and posted messages. The Army said in the statement that hackers compromised an element of the Army.mil service provider's content. After this came to our attention, the Army took appropriate preventive measures to ensure there was no breach of Army data by taking down the entire website. A group calling itself the Syrian Electronic Army claimed responsibility for the hack and said it left messages on the U.S. Army website, including one saying, "Your commanders admit they are training the people they have sent you to die fighting." That's kind of confusing.
It's not that confusing.
Your commanders admit, there's just a lot of words. Your commanders admit they are training the people they have sent you
who
to die.
They have sent, I would
yeah,
say.
Okay,
but it's a non-native speaker, and it's fine.
A copy editor could have made that a little better.
Well, obviously, the Syrian Electronic Army, to the extent they exist, doesn't have a
and,
copy
you
editor.
You know, we're taking their word for it that the Syrian Electronic Army, some people are saying, oh, you know what, there's a bunch of bored Russian kids now. Now, when a website gets hacked, it could be anybody doing it, and just because you put a name on it doesn't mean that's necessarily the person behind it.
I just like the military tactics of if a part of a website is hacked, then you take down the entire website, and, you know, I'm just glad they stopped short of taking off and nuking the entire internet from orbit, just to be sure.
I mean, I wish they had just shut down the entire military as an extra precaution, but I guess that's not so likely.
I think you need to hack more than one website for that.
Okay. Hey, Kyle, anything from you out there before we connect Bernie in?
Oh, no, I've been listening along here. I think the dumbest hacks are yet to be seen. And they're also all around us.
Well, are we working on something? The dumbest hacks are yet to be seen. Yeah, I suppose there's some truth to that. There's never a shortage. Okay, one final story, then we're going to switch over to Bernie. And this is something I believe, Rob, you found this story. Australian academics who teach mathematics may need to run new ideas by the Department of Defense before sharing them or risk imprisonment. Yeah, this is kind of crazy. Some academics are set to become much more familiar with the department's Defense Export Control Office, known as DECO. They're a unit that enforces the Defense Trade Control Act, known as DTCA, of 2012. Until recently, DECO only regulated physically exported weapons and so-called dual-use items, such as encryption, computing hardware, and biological matter. But in March, the act was updated to include intangible supply, which is intended to prohibit the transfer of knowledge from Australia that could be used to produce weapons. What does that mean? Knowledge from Australia? First of all, who contacts Australia when they want to know how to make a weapon? No, I mean, no offense. There's plenty of sources.
Well, you know, pop culture has taught me that Australians know what is and isn't a knife. So going from there, I think the country must have some sort of weapons expertise. This story was sent to us by a friend of mine, an Australian teacher called Nathan, who's a listener of the show. And he actually suggests that maybe we go back to the DECSS days of, like, illegal T-shirts and so on, just to see if we can somehow get this restricted Australian knowledge out into the world.
I mean, you edited the headline when you read it, because it's Australian English, so it says, "Our math teacher is Australia's newest threat," in the Australian press, and I wonder if they should
math
just...
Math, plural, maths.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
It's a hard word
so
to say.
I think they should just limit themselves to one math at a time, maybe to reduce the threat.
You have a problem with polymaths?
Yeah.
Okay.
Maybe the Australian government does, too. That's all I got is making fun of Australian English.
What exactly could theoretically be included in this?
I mean, so a lot of modern crypto, all modern crypto is based on number theory and other branches of mathematics. And so if you are doing research into number theory or into anything else that could one day be used for encryption, then it is possible that the DECO could try and get you to stop. And this is going to force, if actually enforced, and who knows what will happen, but this is going to force people who want to do this kind of work to not live or publish in Australia, which is really pretty foolish of the Australian government, in my view, but obviously I wasn't consulted.
Yeah, they're maintaining something called the Defense Strategic Goods List, or DSGL, and that's the list of, I guess, things that are particularly scary that you don't want to get out of the country. And among the technologies covered by this are the 512-bit key length of the RSA algorithm, which those of us who were around in the 1990s might remember the days when the U.S. government tried to restrict the export of high-strength encryption and decryption tools. We had things like web browsers that had to have a weak and a strong version in order for it to be allowed to be put up for international download. And eventually, the United States government did realize that this was kind of ridiculous. But here we are 20 years later, and the Australian government seems to be taking up the idea.
And how has it been received online?
I think it's been, it's certainly had a couple of laughs. I don't know if there's any other sort of organized response to it going on.
I think there's quite a bit of discussion going on about this. I can't imagine them being able to successfully prosecute anybody for this kind of a thing. And I don't know who comes up with these ideas. They know they're going to be just completely dissected and ridiculed.
They don't know. That's the thing.
How do they not know this?
They don't know. They don't think about... They don't care about the public domain. They don't care about people discussing things in public. They just hear the word encryption. They think that a bad person could use it. And they're like, oh, we got to cut down on it. And they don't know what they're doing. I really don't think it's malice so much as incompetence.
Yeah, and there has certainly been a response to this by experts in the field. This article quotes a few of them, including America's own Bruce Schneier, who most people in this field know and love. And what he says is, what is likely to happen is that Australia becomes isolated as the research and the researchers move elsewhere. No one wants to work somewhere where there's totalitarian-like controls on thought, which I think is a good thought.
Interesting. Okay, well, that's the latest from Australia. And actually, before we let Kyle go, one more story I just want to focus on. This is there's no other word for it. It's a shameful story that appeared in Wired a couple of days ago. The headline screams, "Hacker can send fatal dose to hospital drug pumps." My God, this is Wired. You'd think maybe they have a clue technologically, but this just screams of the New York Post or something. The story begins. We'll just read a little bit of it because that's all I think any of us can stomach. When security researcher Billy Rios reported earlier this year that he'd found vulnerabilities in a popular drug infusion pump that would allow a hacker to raise the dosage limit on medication delivered to patients, there is little cause for concern because obviously it was only a hacker that could do this, not anyone else. Altering the allowable limits of a particular drug simply meant that if a caregiver accidentally instructed the pump to give too high or too low a dosage, the pump wouldn't issue an alert. This seemed much less alarming than if the pumps had vulnerabilities that would allow a hacker to actually alter the dosage itself. Now Rio says he's found the more serious vulnerabilities in several models of pumps made by the same manufacturer, which would allow a hacker to surreptitiously and remotely change the amount of drugs administered to a patient. Basically, the story goes, it's an interesting revelation, but to basically frame it this way, where a hacker is the only person that would do this, hackers are dangerous, hackers will kill you, I expect better from a magazine like Wired. I really do. And I just wonder, what were they thinking? How would you guys say this? How would you phrase these paragraphs?
I would say maybe medical equipment manufacturer releases products with vulnerability. But
a lot of words there.
That might not get in so many ad clicks.
Yeah, you need to get the ad clicks. I admit it, you need to do that. But is basically getting people scared to death over hackers the only way to do that?
I think this is fine.
You think this is fine?
Yeah.
You're
I think this is how the word hacker has come to be used, and words mean what people use them to mean. And I think the battle's over.
So hacker is a criminal
I think that is one meaning of the word. That is the one they're using here.
That is the meaning of the word. How can there be another meaning when you have something like this?
Lots of words have more than one meaning.
Yeah, but when you describe somebody in such an evil context.
I would say that the guy, what was the guy's name in the first paragraph?
Billy Rios.
Billy Rios, I think, is a hacker in the most positive sense. He explored this product and figured out the vulnerabilities in it and how he's concerned that hackers in a more negative sense are going to take advantage of these vulnerabilities.
Okay, but you know, there are words. There are words to describe people that do things that are crimes.
Yeah, and this is one of them.
Why does it say human? I mean, it says general as that, you know? Allow a human to raise a dosage limit. I mean, yeah, the word has many meanings, but, you know, good and bad. But this, you know, from a magazine that supposedly serves this community, it's shameful.
Okay, so if you want to use hacker in the headline, and we could use it to refer to this person who's
how about hacker discovers this in the first place? Because
hacker
he's probably
this.
A hacker himself.
Hacker could pump you full of drugs, but chooses not to.
Uh-huh. Kyle, any thoughts from Seattle before we let you go?
Well, I think it's like really standard now to sensationalize anything that is involve the technology because it's really like sexy. It's something. It's in vogue. People are using apps now, and so are their parents. And so you know these news stories come up. It gets people's attention, and it sells. I don't know. Maybe some sort of paper or magazine or something like that. But it gets people all up in arms. But overall, I think it's just a larger trend of, like, fits and spurts. And that goes for the previous story, too. I mean, maybe he realized it about the pump, the medical pump, but maybe he works for one of these state correctional people. And, you know, they're trying to figure out how they can administer death sentences or something, you know? I mean... And he was just, you know, it's just another day on the job for him, and he just accidentally talked about it or something. But the other thing, too, I mean, I think with exports of, like, encryption, Americans don't realize how lucky we are to be able to use some of the technology that isn't allowed in other parts of the world. But I also am not so naive to think that those places are going to come up with their own technologies, and I think creating weapons and knowledge around physics and that sort of stuff is a little bit different than encryption as far as like communications and privacy and information. But
you know, let's
again, yeah,
let's look at the issue of surveillance, another hot topic. And I always see in the tabloids that the big threat comes from hackers. Hackers can listen in on your phone calls. Hackers can do this. And now we know damn well it's the government doing it. It's corporations abusing your privacy and neglecting your security. Yet it always gets pointed out that hackers are the ones who explain it, who figure it out, who expose it. This is doing the same thing. It's basically saying that hackers are the threat. Hackers are the ones to be afraid of. It has a very negative effect on our entire community because if you call yourself a hacker, all of a sudden you're suspicious, you're evil, you have no morals whatsoever because of characterizations like this. And it also hurts people who think that, oh, well, there's no hackers around, I guess I'm safe. You know, the fact of the matter is, with this particular story, a hacker could change the dosage of drugs delivered to patients. Anybody can do this. The story is that there is no security, no good security to prevent this sort of thing from happening. That is what should be focused on. And it just really rubbed me the wrong way.
I mean, I hope and expect that the manufacturers of these devices will fix their problems so that, you know, actual malicious people do not exploit these vulnerabilities.
Malicious people, what are those? Malicious people, wow, you just came up with a new phrase to describe malicious people. You didn't use the word hackers.
Yeah, there's lots of...
I'm impressed.
English is a very flexible language.
It is.
Lots of words have more than one meaning. Lots of concepts have more than one way to say them.
Mm-hmm. They're very true, and I think we should try and teach Riot how to do that and use different words than hackers. Kyle, any last words from you, because we're going to switch over to Bernie on the East Coast.
Oh, I've got lots of words, but last words on that, I would just say that, you know, we should be mindful of the machines that we're entrusting our lives to. If you're using these kinds of pumps, it's... something to be aware of, that that thing could be out of your control. There could be safeguards and mechanisms where other people could take control, and You know, that's a euphemism for so many things we see and experience every day. So tell other people about it too, and that's about all I'll say there. And inspired. You know, there's lots in your own life. It's not just hacking systems and things around you. You know, you can hack your own life, your own perspective, easily. You know, from the comfort of your hammock or wherever you do your hacking. And I think that's the crux of the discussion over jargon and terminology and the media. And that's it. I mean, that's the distinction. That's the only distinction I can think of.
You know, what I'm going to do with this article, I'm going to change every instance of the word hacker to librarian, because the story still is just as true. This would allow a librarian to raise the dosage limit on medication delivered to patients. I almost said the wrong word again. A librarian could surreptitiously and remotely change the amount of drugs administered to a patient. The point is, a librarian could do this, but they do other things too. And it's just completely ridiculous to characterize people in this way. Hey, Kyle, we're going to let you go. Good hearing from you, and hope to see you again in our new studios that are still being built. And we're going to try and connect with Bernie.
Yes, thanks. Thanks for letting me chat, and I'm excited. I've been hearing little reports and updates, rumors, if you will, that there's progress.
And so, if you listen carefully, you can hear hammering.
Oh wait.
People are building things.
Is that that noise is?
Oh, wait, or somebody locked in the bathroom. I'm not sure which it is, but one of those things.
Excellent.
Okay, and I think Kyle's building something out there, too. Okay, good hearing from you. We're going to try and raise Bernie now, and that's going to take all of my concentration. So you guys carry it for a little bit.
We will do. We have a story that's relevant to our fellow librarians and hackers and all sorts of other creepy characters. This comes from Wireless Week, which it's a story about FCC rebooting the Lifeline program. Some of you may know about the Lifeline program, which apparently has been around for 30 years, but hasn't actually accomplished much. FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler today announced a series of proposals he hopes will reboot Lifeline. And the word reboot is in quotes because that's what we do with those. Among the proposals that the FCC will seek comment on is a new set of minimum service standards, Lifeline being a program designed to make communications access affordable for low-income Americans. They're looking to increase competition on price and service offerings. Wheeler says the new proposals built on 2012 Lifeline reforms built to crack down on fraud and waste because, you know, when you're providing service to the low-income and the unfortunate, you really have to crack down on all that fraud and waste involved in this process. Wheeler's primary focus...
Wait. Yes. I'm sure there's plenty of fraud and waste in this process. I doubt very much of it is coming from the users of the program, but I am sure that there is some fraud and some waste to be found.
Well, this is already coming from Tom Wheeler. FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler, who is probably the most trustworthy figure that we've ever lied entirely about like that. He says, because low-income consumers disproportionately use smartphones for internet access, this puts them at a disadvantage at a time when broadband access is essential for access to education and information, for managing and receiving health care, for daily tasks like accessing government services, checking bank balances, finding bargains on goods and services, and more. Wheeler said this in a prepared statement. Other countries, I remember it was in the news a couple of years back when Finland decided that broadband was a civil right that citizens should have access to. I'm sure the providers who have to actually put up the equipment for these feel differently. Yes, Sprint says upfront costs pose a significant barrier to the target customers of the Lifeline deal. The carrier suggested future versions of Lifeline mobile broadband offers include a subsidy for hardware because, you know, they don't want to pay for things.
I mean, that sounds reasonable. Look, more and more of stuff is online. People need to get online. Not everyone can afford commercial rates to do so. This program seems reasonable. I don't know the specifics of the proposal to know if those are reasonable or not, but the direction, I think, is the right one. Giving people a subsidy to have, you know, landline phones and 100 minutes of long-distance calls a month or whatever the old plan is not what people need anymore, or not what everyone needs anyway.
And so it is spoken. Okay, and joining us now from Philadelphia, Bernie S.
Greetings from Philadelphia. I'm a little nervous, Emmanuel, if you hear my voice. A U.S. military helicopter has been circling at low altitude around my home.
Oh, it arrived. You know, that's just a little surprise package from us. Let the guys in, and they'll have something for you.
It looks like a UH-60 Blackhawk. In any case, I have no idea what they're doing. I've never seen this before, circling so low. But anyway, hey, I have a nomination for Dumbest Hack and the Smartest Hack.
Okay, let's hear it.
The dumbest hack, there's a whole lot of them, is that people manage to take over a website, and they totally squander and waste the opportunity by posting something really stupid. When you have such a global audience of a well-trafficked website,
absolutely,
wouldn't it be more useful to post something that's really going to make a difference or make a real point instead of just some silliness? How many times has this happened?
Yeah, that's very true. It's like the equivalent to graffiti you see in the real world. There are some really clever things written and really clever pieces of artwork done on, you know, in the form of graffiti. But there are also a lot of people that are just writing their stupid name and doing nothing else.
It's rare that you have someone who's politically aware, someone who follows world events, and somebody with technological skills together in the same room at the same time or in the same body at the same time. Who's able to say something intelligent when they get that kind of, it's kind of like elected office too, you know. You have people that are good at getting elected, but then when it comes to actually doing something intelligent, it's a different skill set, you know.
Yep.
All right, well.
On the smartest hack, go ahead.
Yes, go ahead. No, the smartest hack, I want to hear that.
The smartest hack, I think, was something you were referring to earlier tonight when, what Rob was referring to when reasonably strong encryption was considered a munition in the United States and we couldn't export PGP without risking being charged with a felony or worse. But so the clever hack, which some of us in the hacker community remember, is that someone printed all the code for PGP and on paper and then mailed it overseas, which was completely legal because it was printed. It you know, it was First Amendment thing. It was on the printed page, and then it was retyped at a hacker conference. I think that was in Germany. And then it was legally exported, and then the cat was legally out of the bag. It was already out of the bag anyway, but...
They really typed it? They didn't scan it?
I think it was scanned, but it was hand-read and hand-verified because they had to verify that it was, you know, checksums and all that. There were human eyes involved in verifying that it was properly inputted. I think it was a combination of human eyes and OCRing. But I thought that was a really clever hack that got around a restriction, and it had a really good end in that the U.S. government gave up trying to criminalize the export of PGP.
Well, I mean, I don't know if you can credit the people who mailed it with that being overturned, but it's more of a symbolic act to just show how ridiculous such rules are. And for that, yes, I agree, it is a very smart thing.
Yeah, the same thing happened with the good old DECSS code when people weren't allowed to put the code online. So for some very clever people sang it in songs instead or drew it in illustrations or all sorts of other things that were getting the information across without falling afoul of the rule.
Yeah, the point is to always challenge ridiculous laws. Like when we were being sued for DECSS, we took it off our website, but we continued to have links to other websites. They told us we weren't allowed to have links, so then we got rid of the links and just printed a list. And then that's when they stopped telling us not to do things because they realized this is going to go to a bad place that we can't control because after the list, we were ready to just have it in conversational text. And, you know, basically the end result would have been to tell us to just shut up and not talk anymore at all. And fortunately, it didn't get that far. We lost the case, but wound up educating a lot of people, which was pretty good. Hey, Bernie, this story is actually... a week old, and there's an update to it today, but I wanted to focus on it a little bit because it's so absurd and crazy just the way it was being addressed. It has to do with the train crash that took place down there. Members of Congress last week were pointedly questioning Federal Rail investigators over why they still didn't know whether the engineer operating the train was using his cell phone when it crashed on May 12th. 3 weeks later, I just don't understand what the holdup is, said Representative Barbara Comstock of Virginia. It was the first congressional hearing into the derailment. Adding to lawmakers' frustration was that the National Transportation Safety Board has access to the engineer's cell phone and password, but has not nailed down an answer. It seems, said Representative Lee Zeldin, if you get the access to the phone, you look at the phone, you know the answer in like 5 minutes. "We were surprised by the complexity of it ourselves," responded the safety board's chairman, "and we're experts at this." Christopher Hart told the House Transportation Committee that while investigators know that the phone was used on the day of the crash, the precise timing of that use is not yet clear because of discrepancies among various sources of information. He could not say whether the phone was on or off at the time of the accident. The timestamps on the phone's text and calls, for example, are in different time zones. The phone had a California number. He said there are some discrepancies between times on the phone and those in cell phone company records. Yeah, first of all, this, the update. Today it was revealed that, in fact, the guy was not on the phone. Was not texting. But prior to all that, there was all this this bafflement and mystery. How hard is it to figure out these discrepancies? Time zones? Okay, you know, your voicemail might say California time when you're actually in East Coast time. You add 3 hours, you know? It's not that difficult. Is this really something? Am I missing something, Bernie?
No, I think it should have been pretty easy to determine this. I think any reasonable investigator could have, reasonably smart investigator could have figured this out in, you know, in less than an hour, given access to the data. But what you said today, just now, isn't exactly true. The National Transportation Safety Board did announce today something about the use of this Amtrak engineer's phone. But here's what they said. They said analysis of the phone records does not indicate that any calls, texts, or data usage occurred during the time the engineer was operating the train. Okay, that's good. Earlier, I heard something earlier in the radio data. He wasn't operating it in the moments leading up to the accident. So I thought that was kind of shady when I heard that in the radio about an hour ago. So during the time the engineer was operating the train, maybe apparently he wasn't operating the train when the accident happened. And he'd have been operating it when the crash.
Well, he was operating. He was just operating it wrong. He was increasing the speed instead of decreasing the speed, which would have been the right thing to do. But there's also speculation that people were firing projectiles at trains. In fact, there were three other trains that were hit by projectiles in that very area. And it's possible the guy was simply stunned by something and wasn't able to do what he was supposed to do for a few seconds, and that was enough. That's the speculation.
Yeah, but he was accelerating for quite a while up to the sharp curve. So it'll be interesting to see how this all pans out, but there's a lot of information that we haven't seen yet.
I mean, we don't know what happened yet, and it sounds like some investigators are looking, and maybe we'll find out. But I do note the tendency here for the people in Congress to just instantly point the finger at this guy who is just some guy. We need systems that are more resilient than this one guy making an error that it turns out he didn't even make. And it's a real convenient excuse, I think, for some of these forces who wish not to invest in the infrastructure that would actually be safe and resilient to some of these errors to say, oh, well, if this just guy hadn't done this one thing.
Right.
I think we have to be a little bit careful of falling into that trap.
Well, there was what's the technology called? That
has the so-called positive train control.
Positive train, that's a good name. Positive train control. It was installed on the southbound tracks, but not the northbound tracks. And apparently, it has something to do with ham radio frequencies. They were supposed to go out and obtain ham radio frequencies after Congress told them they had to do this. Do you know anything about that, Bernie?
It wasn't frequency spectrum that had been allocated to the amateur radio service. It was different frequencies. But I think that's a red herring. That wasn't really the holdup. I think there were other implementation issues that were more serious. It's funny, all these big companies are always clamoring for more spectrum. We need more spectrum. We need more spectrum. They should use what they have more effectively. They already have spectrum that they can use for this kind of stuff. But it's kind of a ruse, I think.
Uh-huh. Well, that was one of the reports I read, was that they didn't have access. They had to negotiate to buy spectrum. And it just seems that if Congress is serious about having these rules put in place, you don't just throw it to Amtrak and say, you know, get this done and jump through all these hoops. You jump through the hoops, you make sure it happens, because, you know, they've got a train network to run, and they should be, as Mike said, investing in the infrastructure and making it better, making it actually maybe high speed one day.
I mean, there are people in the Congress who it fits their political narrative for shared infrastructure like Amtrak to fail so that they can then privatize it and build roads, which they somehow believe are not shared infrastructure, and all this stuff. So we have to be careful when they try and point fingers, if the people they're pointing the fingers at actually have the power to make the difference, or if they've been denied that power and then get blamed anyway.
Well, one thing that I think a lot of members of Congress don't seem to realize is that you can have both. You know, Kyle and I were driving around in Germany in a rental car. We noticed a lot of people drive in Germany, and a lot of people take trains in Germany, and they both prosper. They both are well-maintained. They both go really fast. You don't have to choose between one or the other, and there are very simplistic people in Congress that seem to think that if they do something positive for trains, they're hurting their beloved auto industry.
In order to do that, though, you have to invest in both, and that is something that the Republicans in particular, but also a lot of Democrats, are not interested in doing.
All right. Well, hopefully that discussion continues as a result of that tragedy. Bernie, anything else on that before we move on?
Not about the Amtrak incident that happened here in Philadelphia, but it's a serious tragedy. I think like 8 people died, and this can I think it's less likely to happen now just because they're going to be paying more attention. We'll just see.
Yeah, but you know, now we're afraid of fast trains. You know, if you go fast, you might something bad might happen, and it's just the way we think sometimes is astounding. Okay, there is word from one of our listeners, and we looked into this and found a story of those fake mobile towers. They're popping up now in England. Stingray boxes, fake mobile towers that scoop up data from passing phones. They're routinely being used in London. That's according to an investigation by Sky News. Working with German security company GMSK Cryptophone, it claims to have uncovered direct evidence. The first in the, those are Cryptophone people that we know?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. How about us? Our friends. Rob, yeah. Barry, those people. Well, yeah. Good for them.
I assume they're still involved in the company, but it's the same company.
Well, it wouldn't exist if it wasn't for them. Yeah. So, wow. So they claim to have uncovered direct evidence. Hackers have uncovered evidence. Look at that. Wow. I wonder how Wired would write this story. This is the first time in the UK this has been noticed, at least 20 instances of the use of these cell site simulators. They basically can be used to track police suspects, but they can be used to track anybody, really. Metropolitan Police Service refused to confirm or deny it was using them, so that probably means they were. And all the data captured by the investigation has been put in a Google document, so now you know NSA has it. Interesting. Are we surprised by this?
No. The UK government has really shown their willingness and excitement to be ahead of the game when it comes to building a surveillance state. So if we know the U.S. is doing something, the odds are pretty high that the U.K. was doing it a couple of years before. I'm not surprised in the slightest.
Well, they say, according to advocacy officer Matthew Rice, he says, we can't be sure that all these are used by law enforcement agencies. They can be used by criminals and are easily bought from the internet for about £1,000. Is that true? We can just buy a Stingray ourselves for about, $1,800?
I think with the exchange rates, it's even less. That's not a lot of money at all for a fake cell site.
Bernie, can you look into this?
I've seen reports and then I've seen videos online of people demonstrating them at U.S. hacker conferences that could be put together for about $1,500. So that'd be about right, about £1,000.
Okay.
Yeah. If we have any particularly generous listeners, I think at least one of our birthdays must be coming up.
Well, now the Hope Conference will be coming up next year, so it'd be a fun thing to play with.
It would indeed.
Of course, it's probably extremely illegal, isn't it?
I'm sure there's somebody who would cry about it.
But it's not illegal if you're law enforcement. So maybe if we somehow, between now and next year, become law enforcement, we can do this.
But if I remember correctly, if we're using one of these, we're not allowed to talk about it, so who would know?
Well, we're just talking theoretically. So
yes, of
course.
There
you go. Okay, what else we got? NSA's hacker hunt has widened. Yeah, without public notice or debate, the Obama administration has expanded the National Security Agency's warrantless surveillance of Americans' international internet traffic to search for evidence of malicious computer hacking. That's according to classified NSA documents. In mid-2012, Justice Department lawyers wrote 2 secret memos permitting the spy agency to begin hunting on internet cables without a warrant and on U.S. soil for data linked to computer intrusions originating abroad, including traffic that flows to suspicious internet addresses or contains malware. The Justice Department allowed the agency to monitor only addresses and cyber signatures patterns associated with computer intrusions that it could tie to foreign governments. But the documents also note that the NSA sought to target hackers even when it could not establish any links to foreign powers. So, again, hackers are the exception, and no doubt because of stories like the Wired story, they are seen as the biggest threat to our freedoms. And, yeah, of course, if you're a hacker, you don't have the same rights as other Americans. Seem right to you?
It seems interesting that we're poking around at people that are ostensibly outside American jurisdiction and influence, and using that as an excuse to just, I'm sure they're capturing more than that off of what they've got attached to things.
It's a really fascinating story. I recommend people read the story that ProPublica and the Times published about it. It's, we shouldn't be surprised, of course, another example of NSA overreach. But, hey, another example of NSA overreach, and it's really quite something, this one.
It's easier to tell the public that foreign people are scary, I think.
Or hackers are scary. That's
foreign
the thing.
Hackers, forget about it.
And the more you demonize hackers, the easier... It's like having... You know, how prisoners have their rights abused constantly, and eventually, prisoners and soldiers, eventually those are trickled down into the populace, and we all get to deal with being watched, being analyzed, having all kinds of chemicals fed into us because it's already been tried on this controlled population. Well, now hackers, walking around free at the moment, are the evil group of people that it's okay if you violate the rules if you're catching a hacker.
I mean, the other thing that was shown in this investigation is that the NSA doesn't throw out data, right, once they collect it. So they make up an excuse, like, this data, we want it because it's related to a hacker, and a hacker is, of course, not a legally defined term, so they can just make stuff up. And then they collect the data, and then they have data that they would not otherwise be legally, even in their own view, allowed to collect, and data on Americans, which, if you believe Americans deserve more privacy than other people for some strange reason, then that's a big shame. And so they have this additional data, and then they can do whatever they want with it because they have it, and they obtained it by reasoning that in their self-contained world is legal.
Yeah, so we have the foreigners and the hackers getting hold of our secret data, and in the medicine pumps story, they're also interfering with our precious bodily fluids. I, for one, am afraid of everything.
As well you should be. Mission accomplished. That's what the media does. Okay. I wish we could take phone calls because there's so much to talk about. I want to hear what people are saying. But, you know, we have our email address, and you can write to that email address, which is oth@2600.com. We cherish every bit of email that comes in and that we get to read and digest, even if it's critical. You know, I'm gonna read a critical email here because we do get a bunch of those as well. And you know, the more critics, the better. I think keeps us on our toes. oth@2600.com. Let loose. You know, use foul language if you have to, if that's the way you express yourself. But we won't read that over the air. Okay, come on, guys. How are you gonna ask listeners for expert advice to help you understand the story when? And here we go, all caps. But I can't scream this loud. None of you even bothered to watch the Gurkhan video of Chris Roberts' presentation. The video answers many of the questions you asked each other and listeners. If you guys aren't going to care about the accuracy of the news you are reporting, asking listeners for information already sent to you, I'm not going to care either. Wow. This letter comes from listener Angelo, who we definitely rubbed the wrong way with that story. Chris Roberts being the guy that supposedly hacked an airplane, claimed to have flown it sideways or turned it sideways. Here's the problem I have with this letter. It goes on for quite a bit. We'll read more of it in a little bit after we have a chance to catch our breath. You don't give any information to correct us. You tear us apart that we got it wrong, but you don't tell us what the right story is.
I mean, I think the fundamental disagreement I have with this letter's writer is that the person in the video who he's instructing us to watch has shown himself not to be the most reliable source of information.
Oh, you did it again. You did it again. You trashed the guy. And now we're going to get another letter saying that you should have watched a video, Mike.
But of him.
Before you said that.
But a video of him.
Do you know what you said? Because you have to think about this now, and you have to come back and say it back. I'm not going to tell you what you said that was so offensive. But if you do your research and watch a few videos and read some books and come back next week, maybe you will have learned something. But I'm not going to say anything. And if you don't care, I don't care either.
All right.
That's what I have a problem with, is letters like that. You know, tell us what we did wrong. Show us that we're wrong. Convince us. This is not convincing.
I would like to see some third party sources analyses of this guy's video, explaining if his claims in the video. We know the claims in the video. We don't know if the claims in the video are correct or not, and watching the video is not going to give us that information.
I'm returning to the letter now. I have always defended Off the Hook as a good news source. You are starting to be more unreliable for accuracy. And here we go, all caps again. Accuracy was the entire reason I started to listen to you in the first place. You slammed Chris Roberts as someone who is non-credible while siding with large enterprises who have a very strong business interest in covering this up. No, we didn't. We simply reported that, you know, there are people who doubt this, that maybe the story doesn't... A lot of it was theoretical. We don't know. That's one thing I think we said over and over again. We don't know the facts. Continuing, you invited Chris Roberts to be on your show to clear things up after completely slamming him, oblivious to the fact that Chris Roberts made a statement that he can no longer comment on the story. Well, you know what? When you can't comment on something involving you, then people are going to speculate. And I don't know how we're supposed to get around that.
But surely there are people who are knowledgeable about this more than we are, because none of us are aviation experts, and they can comment on the story. What we've always tried to do on this show is not only report the news, but discuss it, throw things back and forth, and see how much more information we can get on it. And this is a case where, yeah, we asked our listeners for help with that, as we always do, because, you know, that's important to us to get all the info we can that's available, and we're not going to catch everything.
We don't know everything. We don't even know that much.
The strength of the hacker community has always been that we have such a diverse crowd that can, you know, there will be someone who knows more about this than we do and can maybe share that.
Well, you may know of a video that answers these questions. You know, we either don't know about it or we don't have the time to go through and look at all this. This is what conversation is for. Here we have a couple of paragraphs here where an opportunity was given to tell us exactly what the story is, and it's not there. Let's finish up the letter. Good job, guys. And I think that's sarcastic. So glad this was all done during a fundraiser show. And thank you, everybody, who called in for the fundraiser, made it a success.
Hey.
I know you asked listeners to be easy on you, but when did Off the Hook ever take it easy on anyone else, calling out the very same issues? Well, yeah, we are hard asses as far as that goes. Thanks, Angela, for the letter, though. Really, seriously. And write us more letters, critical and non-critical, and that goes for everybody else as well. We do love to get letters.
And I do take issue with what he said about us asking listeners to go easy on us, because I have never asked for that. You know, if we misspeak, let us know about it.
When did we ever ask listeners to go easy on us?
We've always been totally open to being corrected and, in fact, appreciate it when it happens.
Yeah, I even said before, go crazy. Use obscenities. I said that. You can just let loose and don't spare us any thoughts whatsoever. Bernie, any feedback from you on this?
I agree with you guys on this story. We don't have enough information on this to verify any of it. It's true. Supposedly FBI is investigating. And if he really did any of this stuff, I am quite sure he'll be charged with a crime and probably in short order. If he's not, then I think it says something about the guy's credibility.
Well, I mean, the story here, which a lot of us seem to be forgetting, is that if it's true, it means that there are severe problems in the airline industry that allow people to tap in and control the flight path or the altitude or whatever that an airplane currently is embarked upon. That is a huge story, regardless of who did it or what they said. And if it's not true, and I think this is kind of the thought process we had a few weeks ago, if it's not true, then, you know, the credibility is in question here. If it is true, we need to be talking about it. We need to be, holding the people, and this guy is not the one responsible, the people designing the systems and hooking them up so that this sort of a thing is possible. They're the ones that need to be held to account. And I'm not seeing a lot of discussion about that.
Yeah, if it's true, the story is huge and should definitely be reported further. And if it's, it's open to, I think, further examination right now. And the responsible thing to do is to open ourselves up for more information about it, but maybe not shout it from the mountaintops as gospel just yet.
Uh-huh. If such a thing is possible, I think there's an obligation to expose the information, because covering it up is not going to protect any. It might protect us for a little while, but somebody's going to figure it out, and that somebody might not have the best motives. And in this particular case, if the person did discover it, you know, the first thing to do would be to let everybody know and not just simply hint that you know about this or make other kinds of claims. If this is something that you discover, that you stumble upon, this kind of wide open security hole, the best thing to do is to let the world know. But of course, be careful the channels you use, because as we've seen, authority figures, even journalists, like to point the finger right back at the person that discovered the hole in the first place rather than talk about the security hole. All right. Here's another story that I thought was kind of interesting concerning prosecutors in terror cases. This is happening in Chicago. A Chicago terrorism case. I'm not sure which case that is. Basically, the prosecutors wanted a federal judge to prohibit the defense from mentioning the name Edward Snowden in this terrorism case. Of course, Edward Snowden is the person who disclosed how the courts were able to secretly approve expanded U.S. surveillance methods. Prosecutors worry that the defense could seek to blurt out Snowden's name and related topics at the trial in July. They say the defense shouldn't be able, and this is a quote, to encourage the jury to disregard the evidence because of the means of collection. Well, let's try to read between the lines here. Are they saying that mentioning Edward Snowden's name will just bias the jury into some, well, this must be justified then because Edward Snowden did such an incredible thing for us? What are they actually afraid of? Bernie, any thoughts?
I think the prosecutors are just afraid that they can't make Edward Snowden just disappear. Have you noticed a trend that government authorities are trying to disappear the name and even the image of Edward Snowden? Remember when there was a bust of Edward Snowden installed in Fort Greene Park in Brooklyn, and government authorities?
Yeah, I don't know if that's anything more complicated than a bunch of parks employees not liking someone putting up a statue that wasn't approved. I don't know if it's part of a big conspiracy.
They put a shroud over the sculpture of Ed Snowden's head before they removed it, and then they hid it in a government storage facility.
Okay, but you know what? If we put the statue of you that we have in the warehouse in the same park, I would bet that same shroud would come out because they wouldn't know why that was there.
I don't think they would have shrouded it the same. I just think they hit it with a sledgehammer.
Okay, even if they were reacting to Edward Snowden, I don't think it was in coordination with prosecutors.
It's a trend. It reminds me of the Soviet government's practice of disappearing the pictures and names of people from textbooks and newspapers and statutes and things. It's like after somebody did something that the party disapproved of, and here it is happening in our own country.
Yeah, I definitely don't think it's a big conspiracy where the prosecutor working on the Edward Snowden case called the New York City Parks Department and said, "You better cover this up immediately."
Right.
But I think what is being done and has been done successfully is creating this notion of Snowden and other people like him as such dangerous figures that the Parks Department people, using their own independent judgment, when they found out who this was a statue of, independently decided, oh, we better cover this up. Mm-hmm. And I think you don't need a conspiracy for behavior like that to emerge.
Well, I think, yeah, and I agree with that. But I think it could have gone no further than somebody saying, Edward Snowden, oh, that's an evil person because that's what I heard in the news. That's what has been said and drilled into my head over and over again. It's kind of the same reaction that we saw with people at the hotel when we told them that we were going to have Edward Snowden as our speaker. That guy is bad. He's hurt the country's defense. Just basically line for line, the talking points that have been put out by certain political figures and certain media outlets. And again, I don't think this is a coordinated thing. I think it's just the way that it's been presented over the years so that people have this view that, yeah, this is an evil guy. And it certainly does serve the government's purpose to have people thinking this way. So it's just, it's something that, did they ever get the statue back, by the way?
I think they did.
Did they? Okay.
They did return the statue to its rightful owners. But by that, I don't mean the public. I mean the people who put it there.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that I think we have some judge somewhere who, or some prosecution somewhere who thinks that the merest utterance of the name Edward Snowden is going to, like an incantation, turn the trial against them. I think that says a lot about not only the power of what Edward Snowden did, but the power of his place in history now.
Yes,
where he's in the public consciousness as a certain type of figure, and it's a type that frightens the powers that be. And I think that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, that tells me that that his name actually has a positive effect on potential jurors, as far as protecting freedom, and that's what they don't want to do.
Yeah. Well, actually, the full greater Ed Snowden summoning ritual, you have to stand in front of a mirror and say his name three times and draw a chalk circle on the floor and do some other stuff, but we don't have time to get into that.
No, we certainly don't. And also, just to let people know, we are not on next week. We'll be on in 2 weeks. So there's a special program next week, so you won't hear our cheery voices then, but maybe by the time we get back, we'll have phone lines. We can take listener phone calls. Before we go, though, I just wanted to touch upon the massive data breach that involved U.S. Government employees. Bernie, did you hear anything about this?
Oh, yeah. Millions of these weren't just government employees. These were all people apparently who had either had high-level security clearances or were applying to upgrade them. And millions of people with security clearances or who were applying for them got their personal identifiable information just taken from an unsecure government website. And this is millions of people. This screams to me as an actual espionage hack. This seems like it was well-targeted against people of high value to a foreign government.
And it was immediately blamed on China, and they are kind of denying that.
Wait, Bernie. There are 4 million people in the United States who have a security clearance?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not surprised by that.
That's insane.
It is insane, but I'm not surprised by this level of insanity.
It's over a percent.
It is. Well, you know what? You can probably hear a lot about this in the mainstream media. That's why we didn't discuss that too much. But we'll probably talk about it as the story develops. And the story will no doubt develop in the weeks and months ahead. Again, our email address, oth@2600.com. Again, we're not on next week. Personal Computer Show follows us right now. We'll see you in a couple of weeks. Manual for Off the Hook. Have a good night.
With makeup, bleeding
all over the crowd.
Whoa, he blew his line.
Facing the camera,
he suffered the first.
All right, heart attack. Oh, don't even try to plan.
The most
ironized.
Old pal,
so I want you to be my buddy.
You've got a friend.
Friend, good.
Friends or buddies, as we like to refer to you as here at WBAI. Either way, we invite you to join us and become a member of this fine radio station. We want to partner with you, but we want to do it in the least imposing and most painless way possible. Here's the deal. It's called the Buddy Pledge. You give us your support for 12 months, and we give you access to the most eclectic music, as well as the best and thought-provoking news, talk, and community affairs. Sound good? See it in your heart to pledge a minimum of $10 per month. Each payment will automatically be deducted from your credit or bank statement, so there's no reminders needed. Just join us for a one-year membership and go online at www.give2wbai.org. That's give2wbai.org. And be part of our vibrant community. WBAI New York.
Thank you.
Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is Hanky and Hello World. And joining me this evening is Joe King. And Joe, I believe you're on the line right now.
I am indeed. Max has done his job nobly.
Very good. Well, I just want to tell the audience that we just ended the spring membership drive, and we thank all those who have made pledges in support of the Personal Computer Show. Please make good your pledges. We resume regular programming this evening with a big but. We are preempted next week, June the 17th, for a Brooklyn Town Hall meeting, and then hopefully we'll come back with regular programming on June the 24th. Joe?
The thing I want to point out to the folks, Hank, is that if even though the fundraising is over, if they want to go to the website called Give to WBAI, G-I-V-E, number 2, WBAI, they can make a pledge for their favorite show and get the white paper you and I have been talking about for lo these many weeks.
I just finished it, yeah.
Hank?
And by the way, what we'd like people to do is if they did say that they made a pledge for their favorite program as a Personal Computer Show, send us a piece of email, because what we want to do is not wait for management to process it. We're going to be very proactive. We're going to take your name, and we're going to work with one of the people inside here, and we're going to say, verify. That's all I want you to do, verify. We will send out the email on the white paper. And the white paper is quite comprehensive, Joe.
It covers what sorts of things, Hank?
Yep, and the white paper mainly is on Windows 10, and it's a little bit of this material that was 3 weeks ago, 2 weeks ago, and I have a little more material to add to it. But
it's also got some things in it other than Windows 10. I understand you put in there a way with Western Digital where you can get...
Oh, yes. We were talking about... I had promised that what we said was with solid state drive, you got to be careful how you store it if it's not connected to anything, because there could be loss of data. And I said I will make that article available, and then also have a tech tip that I'm going to talk about tonight. That it's a very important one that I'll include. By the way, Joe, you probably want to tell them that for tonight we're going to do something a little different because of the lack of phone lines.
Yeah, this is a very important thing. Hank went down to the Brooklyn studio a couple of weeks ago for the first time for a live broadcast, and he sat down and discovered, A, he had no desk, but more important, he had no telephone. And I said, Hank, how are you going to do a call-in show without a telephone? So, of course, that week we had no call-in, and we've been thinking about ever since how are we going to do it without telephones, because in its infinite wisdom, the noble leaders of WBAI felt...
Noble? You're giving them a lot of credit.
Yes, well, I'm also being sarcastic.
Oh, okay.
They decided to make their move only lacking a couple of things. Because they only had a couple of years to prepare for the move, the couple of things they lacked was a studio, a telephone.
A console.
They did give you a microphone, didn't they, Hank? Or are you shouting out through that Campbell soup and can?
No, I have a microphone sitting on top of a stool because I have no table.
So in their infinite wisdom, they decided after having 2 years to plan, they would just move without any plans whatsoever. And they did that. So Hank and I sat down and said, you know, a big part of our show over the last 30 years has been the back and forth between you, our audience, and us, and whoever we have on the panel that week. And we tried to think about it, and we finally came up with a kludge that may work. You know, several people said to me, well, why don't you use Skype? But the answer to that was very simple. The board that they put in can't take an input to Skype. So forgetting any of the assistance that we're not getting from WBAI to do this show, I simply opened up a special address at Gmail. That special address is PC Radio Question, PCRadioQuestion at Gmail. And I'll be monitoring that inbox throughout the show.
Live, while we're on the air.
And if you write a question, hopefully Gmail will deliver it promptly. And if it's a general question that, you know, something that you would have asked on the air that we think all the other listeners would be interested in, I'll interrupt Hank and tell him what that question is. I'll respect your privacy. I won't give him your email address, but I probably will use your first name or some identifier so you'll know that it's from you. And we'll see how that works out until such time as Hank is able to put in his own phone system.
You're very hopeful, Joe.
I'm a dreamer.
You know what? Actually, one of the things I want to start off tonight is I want to. We had some last-minute information on Windows 10, and they're talking about what features to expect and what features are have been taken out that's not in Windows 10. And I'm saying to myself, I'm looking at this, and I said, which is going to come first? Now, we know Windows 10 is going to be released on July the 29th, and is it going to be a horse race where the phone lines will come in before July 29th, or do you think Microsoft will beat out WBAI?
What year?
This year, of course.
Well, then Microsoft will win, because I'm not really expecting phone lines to be put in prior to the next millennium.
Okay. Hey, by the way, Microsoft did have a Windows called Millennium.
It died. The ME was really not a step up, but it was a step back.
Right.
What they did was they took the next version of, or the previous version of Windows, and they disabled a number of things.
Right.
Called it ME.
Well,
that was not nice.
With Windows 10, I've been doing a lot of work on it. In fact, I'll be giving a presentation and a demo on it tomorrow at the New York Amateur Computer Club.
Well, where is that, in case anybody wants to go down and...
Well, I'll make the announcement.
Actually,
it's at NYU.
Throw things at you, they can do that also.
NYU, the Silver Building on 32 Waverly, and the room number is 411. Okay.
That's the NYU Silver Building. It used to be called the Main Building.
It was called the Admin Building.
Washington Square Park East.
Mm-hmm.
And you can get there on all the normal mass transit ways. Or, if you're really good, you can call Hank at his home number, which I'll give you in a few
minutes. No. Hey, Joe, let me move on, okay? By the way, in the white paper, I have a section that I've already added with this information, and I call it unofficially official. In other words, Microsoft had made statements, but since they do a lot of flip-flops, you don't know where they come from sometimes. But what they've already announced in the past week was Windows Media Center will no longer be in Windows 10. They're taking it out.
Well, what does that really mean to folks? Because I know a lot of people don't really use Windows Media Center.
Are you kidding me? I had used it extensively.
And why have you used it extensively?
Windows Movie Maker was a part of it, Windows Media Player, and so on.
So you might have used that part of the operating
right.
system just to play your music.
And what they're saying is if you really need it, go find another alternative. The other thing that they are also removing is that, what they said was that if you go through the upgrade, the free upgrade that they're talking about, they're telling you ahead of time that when they do the upgrade, if you happen to have gadgets on Windows 7, it will remove the gadgets, period.
And not replace them?
Correct. Not replace it.
Why are they doing that?
Hey, it's called marketing management, isn't it, huh?
Oh, I would like to tell you.
Another feature that they're removing, or I should say they're no longer supporting in Windows 10, OneDrive.
I don't follow you.
Well, that was with cloud storage, okay, with the inbox version of cloud storage. Now, this one really got me, okay, because I know you're not going to get support for it. They say that starting with Windows 10, if you do the upgrade and you have a floppy disk drive on it, it will wipe out the drive, they will not support it, and if you want the drive for it, you go back to the manufacturer of the floppy drive and ask them to have available a floppy drive for that unit.
You're saying that Windows 10 will not have any support for floppy drives.
And let's be honest. There's no way a Mitsumi or, those that they made a floppy disk drive, that they're going to write drivers for it.
What about the people who are supplying drives that run off the USB?
You still need the drives.
No, you need the driver, but they'll be still manufacturing the drives. Will they get drivers for Windows 10?
No, it's up to the manufacturer to come up with the drives.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Manufacturers of those external floppies.
Now, another thing they said was, and I was surprised they said this, okay, is that Internet Explorer will be made available for enterprise users who depend on it. Now, I've been testing Windows 10, and when you do an install, you can't find Internet Explorer, but it's buried. But you can bring it out. All you do is you go to the program files, from the C drive, and when you go in there, you go to Windows Internet Explorer and right-click on the app program and send to desktop, and it's there. But
why would you want it?
Well, there's a lot of things that are still dependent on Internet Explorer. You know, it depends on how much legacy stuff you have.
Well, I'm puzzled because I have a lot of old stuff, but I'm able to run it on one or another of either Firefox or Opera or Chrome, or I don't need Internet Explorer for any of the things.
Well, some corporations, when they set up certain applications, they did, okay? So that's the reason why they said Internet Explorer will be made available for enterprise users. However, if you happen to be a regular consumer with a home version, you can still bring it out.
I gotcha.
Okay. Now,